Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, February 3rd, 2004. Greetings. We're back again with our Fun Drive special, Treason at the Top. Ralph and I are coming to you by telephone from Vallejo, California. We're glad to be with all of you in the tri-state region of New York and those of you listening via the Internet. So many people have contacted us about Treason at the Top. People who said they missed the Fun Drive special last week, and so today we're going to replay some of what we played last week, and we're going to play some new excerpts from Treason at the Top. Treason at the Top is a 2-CD premium, yours for the generous donation to WBAI of $100. By now, you should all be familiar with the telephone number, but I'm going to repeat it once again, and I hope you take it down. 212-209-2950. If you're listening via the Internet, please call, because the premium isn't yet up on the wonderful WBAI website, www.wbai.org, but it will be soon. So meanwhile, 212-209-2950. I first like to tell you about something that happened only yesterday. I was at an event about 9/11. It was a large comedy event that included Will Durst and the New Yorker Jose Santiago, who's an incredible comedian, political comedian, if you haven't heard him yet in the New York region. And this was a fundraising event for what's going to be a large 3-day inquiry about 9/11, with many of the researchers, including Ralph and myself, speaking here in San Francisco in March. And during the event, someone came up to me who manages one of the very low-power radio stations that the government has been attacking, and he said that he had acquired a copy of Treason at the Top through KPFA, WBAI sister station, and he plays Treason at the Top over and over and over again, broadcasting it throughout a portion of San Francisco on the low-power station, and he wanted to thank us so much for preparing Treason at the Top. We know that even if you don't have a low-power station, you too will want to share Treason at the Top with your friends, your family, and your colleagues throughout the world. 212-209-2950 is very important. Over almost 3 hours, it's a 2.5-hour program, including a presentation by Ralph, a presentation by me, and almost an hour-long question and answer period. Again today, we're going to play several of the questions and answers so that you get a chance to hear some of the interplay that happens about Treason at the Top. And what a day to be presenting Treason at the Top, a day after President Bush unrolled his huge budget, $2.4 trillion, with his increase in the military expenditures at the cost of education, health and welfare, the environment, all the social services upon which we depend, all to go to the traitors at the top, the military-industrial complex. And this is a budget of over $400 billion. It doesn't include the war expenditures for Afghanistan and Iraq. And as we anticipate, war expenditures at other places throughout the world. Ralph?
What's interesting, too, here is that the constant theme that's being echoed here in the newspapers from the Bush State of the Union message is that the theme of imminent danger, of imminent attack, and of the next 9/11, ominous warnings is what the New York Times calls them. And we must remind people that in our two-parter on the testing of the waters of militarization in America, which dealt with the projected military coup of Tommy Franks and of General Barry McCaffrey in the Wall Street Journal, where it was predicted in a cigar aficionado that a military government would be put in place and the Constitution removed when the next attack occurs. Every major spokesperson for this administration, and with echoes from the Democratic Party as well, have told us that there is an inevitable biological attack, mass attack, that will dwarf 9/11.
Well, Ralph, again, with the Rice-in appearing in Speaker of the House Frist's offices today, again, another sign that this is the day to be listening to treason at the top because of what these staged happenings, as Ralph said. The anticipation after Dick Cheney speaks over and over again of biological attacks, they have to stage a biological attack somewhere. Otherwise, there is total lack of credibility.
Well, it's not just ricin. Mysterious powder, says the Idaho News and Associated Press. And mysterious powder being investigated at Connecticut Postal Center. Powder found at postal facilities in Connecticut are being tested. A gray sandy powder, which is suspected to be analogous to anthrax, under test. Headlines in the local newspapers, and now actually from Idaho to Connecticut. Fear of biological weapons grounded flight, says CNN on February 2nd. Fear of bioweapons is the rationale for the canceling of flights to the United States from European capitals. British Airways, Air France, U.S.-owned airlines, their flights canceled on the grounds that these air taxis were delivering biological, chemical, or radioactive weapons as part of a terrorist plot upon the United States. Now, specifically, let's look at the following. Bioweapons in Cuba. February 2nd, 2004, the Florida Senator candidate states, Castro, the master terrorist and primary threat to the United States, is preparing for an all-out biological attack upon the United States. And in his campaign for the Senate, Larry Klayman states, it's time to remove Castro once and for all by force. Klayman, a former Justice Department attorney, stated he's had free rein for too long. All the politicians go around talking about how bad the situation is, the danger of terrorism, the danger of biological attack. If we can do it for the Iraqis, we can do it for Cuba and for the United States. A theme, I have to say, picked up by Democrats, Cuban-American Democrats, Cuban-American Republicans, from Mel Martinez to Miami-Dade Mayor Alex Hanales, supporting removal of the Cuban government by force of arms, Jeb Bush refusing to comment on suggestions that the United States is preparing to invade Cuba to overthrow Castro. Active chemical and biological weapons program is the charge, orchestrated in the World Net Daily, reporting that, quote, Castro cooperated with Iraq's Saddam Hussein in an active chemical and biological war, weapons program. And indeed, this is now attributed to as a causal factor in West Nile virus. The orchestrated theme is clear.
What you're hearing is a taste of what we do on Taking Aim each week from 5 to 6. But what we normally are in a studio, and we have very high quality sound, thanks to the engineers at WBAI and at KPFA. All this is only possible with your support. 212-209-2950, and we prepared a special program for you, Treason at the Top. Right now, we're going to go to the beginning of Treason at the Top, and we'll be back with you in about 15 minutes. But meanwhile, get to your phones, because you can have a copy of Treason at the Top. 212-209-2950. T-Dub.
Good evening. Hello, and thank you for coming tonight. My name is Doug McDonald. I'm one of the co-founders of the Solano Peace and Justice Coalition. And I'd like you to thank you for coming to tonight's forum with Ralph Shulman and Maya Schoen. Tonight's presentation is entitled Treason at the Top, the Dynamics of War and Repression at Home and Abroad, and Your Civil Rights. Ralph Shoman was Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina. He worked with Malcolm X with respect to the battle for the Congo and has negotiated the release of political prisoners in many countries. Today, he is an author and investigative journalist and produces Taking Aim with co-producer Maya Schoen, heard weekly on Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York City. Maya Schoen is an economist and has a long history as an activist involved in political, community, and labor issues. Among her activities over the years, she's worked closely with both Casa Nicaragua and Casa El Salvador during the struggles taking place in Central America. Was the coordinator of the Tri-County, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and San Luis Obispo Labor Party chapter, and was a founder and on the steering committee of Healthcare for All California. Again, thank you for coming and enjoy the evening. And with that, I will introduce Ralph Shoman.
Thank you very much, Doug. I want to express our appreciation to Doug McDonald and to the Solano Committee on Peace and Justice for giving us the opportunity to talk to you tonight. And I appreciate all of your coming out. I hope we'll have an exchange, a good discussion. What we want to address here is the underlying circumstances and dynamics of this but little continuation of a long-standing practice and policy of imperial plunder and devastation on the part of those who hold power in this society. I think it's important that we understand that whether we look at the war that's now devastating the poor and small country of Iraq, the impoverished people of that country that has been so afflicted by imperialism for more than 100 years, a people that lives in the countryside on 30 cents a day, those who work for public service and for the government work for $5 a month, which is 17 cents a day, a desperately poor people, a people long victimized, with a very specific history in relation to both U.S. and before British imperialism. But we in our own society have a structure of power. And I think in order for us to see the context in which these events unfold, tragic as they are, devastating as they increasingly will be, it's necessary for us to see who rules in this country, what it's about. The Department of Commerce in the United States had published statistics that show that about 2% of our population owns and controls some 90% of the national wealth. And in November of last year, the New York Times ran a piece in which that data was shown to be no longer accurate. The figure now is about 1%, owning 95% of the national wealth. They average about 14 corporate directorships per person. The man who had written the book Up the Organization, Robert Townsend, who was the president of Avis and American Express, put it like this. He calculated that approximately 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the United States economy. Now, this is an extraordinary concentration of power. This is a tiny oligarchy that uses its vast control over the national wealth to capture the political process, the one big property party with two names that is financed by the same people repeatedly ad infinitum. And bear in mind, brothers and sisters, that we in our own frontiers have but 5% of the world's population. And yet, this small oligarchy, this ruling class, has command over nearly 70% of the natural resources of the world. By any standard, this is an empire. So imperialism is a specific sociological category. It's not a swear word. It's not a piece of rhetoric. It's a description, a scientific description of the structure of power in our society. And as such, this tiny ruling class requires increasingly a dependence upon arms production, addicted to that arms economy like an addict to his fix, and in ever-increasing doses. In just the past 40 years, $9.3 trillion assigned to the Pentagon. Now, that is more than the combined value of everything produced in this country taken together. Schools and roads and sewers and hospitals, everything together of productive value does not in total equate with the amount of waste production that goes through this arms economy. That is the context. That is the underlying dynamic which requires such wars of predation. As you know, the rationale for this current war against the people of Iraq is the rubric of weapons of mass destruction. In the first 41 days of the Gulf War in 1991, the United States used more tonnages and greater firepower on that country than in the total period of World War II in all theaters taken together. And that represented approximately 300 cruise and Tomahawk missiles. And these people have been telling us, these rulers of ours, that in the first 48 hours of shock and awe, they were going to visit what? Three times that amount of destruction on this small country. Every single missile, every artillery shell, every tank barrage, every bullet is coated with a substance called depleted uranium. In essence, these are tactical nuclear weapons. Because when detonated, the depleted uranium, which is one of the hardest metals on Earth, is radioactive and permeates the aquifer and permeates the soil and permeates the food chain and has resulted in an epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities across Iraq, as it had indeed in Yugoslavia and in the Balkans. Weapons of mass destruction. There is a very particular history about the use of biological and chemical agents, which have been long monopolized by the United States. Doug had mentioned that I had worked as the Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina. Bertrand Russell was the honorary president, Jean-Paul Sartre, the executive president, and a wide range of people who were active politically, intellectually at the time, presided over that inquiry. We documented across Indochina the use of gases that exploded the pupil of the eye, the introduction of plague bacteria, a focus and a panoply of biological and chemical and nerve agents that the United States deployed in Indochina. And only last week, the New York Times on its front page carried a story that this current generation of children in Vietnam is suffering from an epidemic of deformities directly related to the Agent Orange and the other biological and chemical agents that have permeated the soil and the food chain and the atmosphere and have now come to wreak their havoc upon the current generation of children in Indochina. Weapons of mass destruction. A research group called BioConop obtained declassified documents from the United States government which have to do with the history of the use of germ warfare by U.S. rulers. I'm going to give a quick resume of this because I think it puts in context this entire rationale for this devastating war that's being inflicted on the people of Iraq. In 1900, U.S. doctors in the Philippines infected Filipino insurgents and prisoners with the plague. They induced beriberi in prisoners. In 1915, doctors introduced pellagra in Mississippi inmates. In 1931, the Puerto Rican cancer experiment was undertaken by Dr. Cornelius Rhodes under the auspices of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Investigation. Dr. Rhodes infected his subjects with cancer cells, and multiples died. When the experiments were disclosed, the written opinions of Rhodes were as follows. The Puerto Rican population should be eradicated, he stated, on the record. Rhodes went on to establish the United States Army biological warfare facilities in Maryland, Utah, and Panama. He was named to the United States Atomic Energy Commission, and that was the heart of radiation experiments that were carried out by the United States government on prisoners, hospital patients, and soldiers. In 1932, the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, 200 poor black men with syphilis, began a long-term experiment in which these men were to be studied. They were never told not only of their illness, but that the study itself was involved in further infecting the men themselves The government office supervising this was the predecessor to today's Center for Disease Control. In the 1940s, in a crash program to develop drugs during World War II, doctors in the Chicago area under U.S. federal direction infected hundreds of prisoners in Chicago with the disease. In 1950, the United States Navy sprayed clouds of infective bacteria over San Francisco. From 1950 to 1953, an array of germ warfare weapons were used against Korea. They released feathers with anthrax, fleas and mosquitoes dosed with plague and yellow fever, and rodents infected with a variety of diseases. In another series of such experiments, the United States military released clouds of gas over six United States and Canadian cities. In 1955, the Tampa Bay area of Florida experienced a sharp rise in whooping cough, including multiple deaths after a Central Intelligence Agency test where bacteria were released from the Army's chemical and biological warfare arsenal released into the environment. From 1956 to 1958, the same phenomenon in Savannah, Georgia, and Avon Park, Florida. In 1965, a three-year study, prisoners at the Holmesburg State Prison in Philadelphia subjected to dioxin, the highly toxic chemical contaminant in Agent Orange. Lesions were neither treated, nor were the infected persons admitted to hospitals. 1966, the United States Army dispensed bacilli throughout the New York City subway system. 1968 to 1969, the Central Intelligence Agency experimented with poison in the drinking water in a number of cities across the United States. 1969, Dr. D.M. McCarter, Deputy Director of Research and Technology for the Department of Defense, appeared before the House Subcommittee on Appropriations to request further funding for projects for synthetic biological agents for which humans had not yet acquired a natural immunity. He then asked for a further $10 million to produce this agent within the next 5 to 10 years. AIDS first appeared as a public health risk 5 years after this funded activity. Richard Nixon was engaged in biological and chemical warfare agent production throughout his presidency. Ray Ravendut, the director of the Population Program of the U.S. Agency for International Development, announced the agency's goal to sterilize one quarter of the world's women. 1980-1981, detention centers in Miami and Puerto Rico with male Haitian refugees injected with chemicals and biological agents, and a condition resulting called gynecomastia, in which males developed full female breasts. 1981, over 300,000 Cubans stricken with dengue hemorrhagic fever. An investigation by the Covert Action Information Bulletin tracked the documents in which Central Intelligence Agency operatives were systematically disseminating the viral agents for their impact in Cuba. 1982, El Salvadoran trade unionists stated that epidemics of unknown diseases had cropped up in all the areas where U.S.-directed aerial bombings were taking place. 1985, dengue fever strikes Managua, Nicaragua. 1987, the Department of Defense was forced by a lawsuit by a public interest group to reveal that it was operating chemical and biological warfare programs at 127 sites in the United States. In his book, Clouds of Secrecy, Leonard Cole, public health professor at Rutgers and formerly a director of the U.S. Biological Weapons Facility at Fort Detrick, documented what the New York Times acknowledged were, quote, 239 cities and locations in the United States, unquote, where the Pentagon over a period of 40 years released clandestinely hundreds of trillions of bacilli, bacteria, fungi, and spores. In his introduction to Clouds of Secrecy, the late Senator Alan Cranston acknowledged that over 10 million American citizens were affected. These biological agents were deployed by the Pentagon in the subway system of New York, the school systems of Minneapolis and St. Louis, and specifically in the Bay Area, surrounding San Francisco, and environs, where spinal and brain meningitis increased by tenfold as a consequence. And yet, not a day goes by when our rulers fail to declaim that demonic terrorists are preparing to release biological agents in our water supply, our nuclear power plants, and have spread everything from smallpox to anthrax. And I'm sure you'll recall when in the aftermath of 9/11, anthrax was being disseminated in the United States, and the established media were replete with accounts of how the spread of anthrax was indeed the consequence of terrorist activity in this country. The new scientist in London tracked the fingerprint, the DNA, the telltale characteristic of this particular anthrax, which was prepared in United States military laboratories. The fingerprint of military-produced anthrax available and accessible and prepared in military labs in this country. Weapons of mass destruction.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You've been listening to the first part of Treason at the Top, our dynamic program, our premium for your $100 contribution to WBAI at 212-209-2950. How foretelling this premium is, talking about the biological threats, and here we have in the newspaper reports of so-called biological threats in against the Speaker of the House, on and on again. That, for me, has been the significance of what we try to do on Taking Aim. It's really summed up in Treason at the Top, where we take the information that you see, the disparate information that comes to us each day on the radio, in newspapers, in magazines, and all the various media sources, and then we put it together, we synthesize it, we analyze it, we make the what could be chaotic and too overwhelming, we make it so that you can understand what is unfolding in the world today. Ralph?
What we're essentially attempting to do here with the abiding evidence about the role of the United States authorities in the preparation and perpetration, orchestration of the disasters of 9/11, what we seek to do is to illuminate for our audience, for our constituents, for the listeners to our WBAI and to the Pacifica Network at large, to illuminate the realities of a criminal ruling class that is at war with its own people, engaged in a class war, not only against the peoples who they exploit on a planetary scale, but specifically against the people of the United States, the working population of this country. They cannot sustain this system except through pretexts and lies to justify their wars of predation and their deepening of the exploitation of our people, the elimination of their social services, the militarization of our society, the elimination of our rights and our civil liberties. No way could they impose these things without staging events to terrorize the population of this country. This is not a matter of mere hypothesis, but of relentless documentation. That's the task of Taking Aim. That's the burden of Free Speech Radio. That's the mandate of Pacifica listener-supported radio, to speak truth to power. We are engaged here in an attempt to mobilize our listeners and our constituents to support this programming, to support this information. Please call in your pledges. Please order Treason at the Top. Please donate to maintaining WBAI and Free Speech Radio. This is the responsibility that we all have. As you know, Maya and I are unpaid producers, as are so many. On WBAI, we do this out of political commitment. This is not a commercial radio station. The corporate-controlled media will not allow this information to be heard. Of course, we all understand that, but that's ever more by way of explaining and emphasizing the importance of your support for this broadcasting. Please call in. Please order Treason at the Top. We are going to provide you with as much of this information and analysis and political agitation, if you like, as we possibly can on an ongoing basis, and we urge you to support this effort.
WBAI is listener-supported, and recently the Pacifica Chief Financial Officer, Lonnie Hicks, gave a presentation to the staff at KPFA here in Berkeley. And in his presentation, he mentioned that over 77%, that's more than three-quarters of the Pacifica budget, comes from you, the listeners. And that's why we really are listener-sponsored. We are on the air because you put us on the air. We try to present you each week with intense information, intense documentation, analysis, and done in a professional manner. And that takes engineering, that takes the infrastructure staff at WBAI, and the salaries of the people who bring programs to you 5 days a week so that you have continuity. And this is a time, one of the rare times at WBAI, when we ask you to give all you can. Become a member. That's also very important. There's low-income membership at $25. There's a regular membership. And those of you who can give more than the membership, more than the premiums, please do so. In fact, you can get multiple premiums of Treason at the Top to distribute to your friends, your family, and your colleagues for a $100 donation, this 2-CD, very high-quality audio presentation. What's in Treason at the Top? Treason at the Top has the analysis of the structure of power, the history of the use of biological and chemical weapons. It goes into the long-standing plans to capture Iraq, why 9/11 was an essential move on the part of a sector of the ruling class, and today we're going to play a portion of the presentation by Ralph that addresses that. The basis for the attack on our civil liberties, military operations other than war here in the United States, and why the Democratic Party is not a viable option for our support, an important subject given Super Tuesday with the Democratic primaries taking place all in many states around the country.
Well, actually, every single one of the candidates, and does not exclude Al Sharpton or Dennis Kucinich, are campaigning to the right of George Bush on a critical question, and that is the presumptive threat of terrorists to security. Because even those who are critical of the aspects of the war in Iraq, although critical within very strict limits, because they are not critical enough to demand a withdrawal of all forces from Iraq and a restoration of Iraqi sovereignty. Even Kucinich is simply wanting to do a lateral pass to the United Nations to effectively maintain the same sort of occupation, a white man's burden of colonial rule, fundamental violation of Iraqi sovereignty. But each and every one of these people is maintaining that these costs and these expenditures are distracting the U.S. from its war on terror and from what is called homeland security.
Well, that was the theme of the entire theme and presentation by Representative Nancy Pelosi from California, who is the minority whip, the top female in the Democratic Party, a position that she's accumulated over the years by playing the middle in the Democratic Party. And that's what she said over and over again. I took it down, and maybe we'll read some excerpts from it later in the program.
Well, you know,
I do want to remind everyone of the phone number again. We can't hear the phones ringing here, but we know you're calling. I hope you're filling up the phone lines. This is the last week for Treason at the Top, 212-209-2950. I want to let you know that we will be on next week, not in our regular time, because the fund drive is going to continue, but we'll be on from 7 p.m. till 9 p.m. with a special edition of Testing the Waters, Military Rule in America. And this is a follow-up to Treason at the Top. So this is your last opportunity, 212-209-2950 for Treason at the Top.
And let me emphasize, when we talk about the Republicrats and the one big property party with two names, There's been a very important analysis. I will summarize it here. I could give you blow by blow on the ways in which Boeing and Lockheed Martin and the General Dynamics and the Carlyle Group and the military industrial complex profiteers in the trillions of dollars. Not only are on both sides of the aisle are they advocates for this ever-increasing military budget, but when, for example, Tom Daschle, the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, gives the answer to Bush and purports to be striking out a differential between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party on the use of the military and on the budget deficit, it happens to be his wife's role to be the chief lobbyist for Boeing and in promoting the ever-increasing budgets. And that is a characteristic of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party spokespersons. They're funded by the same people. They are wearing the same corporate hat, only the rhetoric varies opportunistically and demagogically.
Well, Ralph, talking about biological warfare, it was during the Clinton administration in 1997, the Department of Defense awarded a 10-year contract to the tune of $322 million for vaccine production to DynPort Vaccine Company, which is a joint venture of DynCorp, known to our Taking Aim listeners for its involvement in the privatization of the military, particularly in Colombia, and a joint venture of DynCorp and Porton Products, which is Fuad al-Hibri's company, and this who owns Bioport, which manufactures the anthrax vaccine and has Admiral Crow on its board of directors. Now, this is for the development of vaccines against acute infectious Q fever, tularema, contagious disease vaccines. And according to Dr. Michael Gilbreth, who is the chief scientist for the joint program for the Office of Biological Defense, DynPort would be called upon to develop vaccines against other biological warfare threats such as, now listen closely, lysine plague, staphylococcal and enterotoxin B, and Venezuelan equine encephalitis. 18 vaccines in all. This was reported by the Wall Street Journal October 19, 2001. And it was reported on Taking Aim in our programming in the beginning of 2002, where we had program after program addressing the issues of biological warfare and the United States' involvement in it. Only on Taking Aim.
And Maya, as you make very clear, the relationship between the production of biological weapons, their testing, and their use, both within the United States and on subject populations in oppressed countries abroad, is a responsibility of the rulers, and they come from both parties. Bioport, which tested its weapons with the Port and Downs facility in Great Britain through al-Hibri, as you describe, and to Admiral Crow, let's make clear that Admiral Crow was not only the ambassador to Great Britain, but formerly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Bill Clinton. And Crow is the director of Bioport, and in his capacity as ambassador to the United Kingdom, the anthrax and other biological weapon agents were being tested on civilians in Portland Downs facility. And this entire apparatus is linked to the pharmaceutical companies. It ties back to the Carlyle Group, which we have documented in great detail, the $14 billion virtual who's who of the Bush administration, deeply involved in the antecedent events of 9/11, linked to Osama bin Laden because the father and the brother of Osama bin Laden were part of the funding of the Bush companies that led to the formation of the Carlyle Group. This entire intimate nexus of corporate rulers and their instruments overseas is indispensable to an understanding of the underlying politics and dynamics of 9/11, the terrorizing of the American people, and this great catalog of lies and fiction, the category of terror, which informs the politics of the rulers and which enables them to perpetuate their control over our politics. We, at our peril, support Democratic Party candidates who tack to the right on the question of the category of terror, invoke the necessity for increasing the enforcement of this war against terror, which is just a formula for the next staged event which will lead to the canceling of our elections, as the Washington Post has said. And one more point before I urge you again, please call this your support. January 21st, 2004, Associated Press, House panel prepares House of Representatives for catastrophic attack. Legislation introduced Wednesday providing for fast special elections or cancellation of the national elections if a terrorist attack incapacitates House members. The measure requires expedited elections under extraordinary circumstances with military control in the event that the Speaker of the House announces that it is required. Now, both Democrats and Republicans were pushing for this legislation, and indeed this is but the demonstration of the intentions and the plans of our rulers when our population, disaffected from their exploitation and their oppression, begins to question in a fundamental way these policies of a decaying ruling class.
212-209-2950. Treason at the Top, two CDs, your $100 donation to WBAI. And remember, if you can't afford more, it is appreciated, very much appreciated. Let's keep WBAI broadcasting in an efficient and an effective manner. And after all, it is WBAI that brings Taking Aim to you over the past more than 2 years now. We're into our third year of broadcasting and being with you, and we've appreciated every moment of and every bit of your support. Now is your opportunity, 212-209-2950. And we're going to return to Treason at the Top.
In military labs in this country. Weapons of mass destruction. It was written in the Boston Globe that when the United States declared its intention to remove Saddam Hussein from power, and Bush gave the authorization to assassinate Saddam Hussein along with any other recalcitrant heads of state or figures in the world of which this regime in the United States would disapprove, the article in the Boston Globe stated that this had something of the air of deja vu, because in 1958 in Iraq, the Iraqi people rose against the puppet regime of Nuri as-Said and the infant King Faisal II, Nuri as-Said, known as the Stooge of Baghdad, an instrument of British imperialism. And in the enormous popular uprising that occurred across Iraq, it brought to power a nationalist officer named Abdul Karim Qasim, who not only legalized the Iraqi Communist Party and the nationalist parties of Iraq, but confined the access of oil corporations to one-tenth of 1% of the area of Iraq. And from that moment, as the Boston Globe acknowledges, the Central Intelligence Agency prepared for the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim. Indeed, the person who was directing that was the station chief of the Central Intelligence Agency in Baghdad. There's a book called Ropes of Sand by Wilbur Eveland, who was with that station, who disclosed that a young 24-year-old leader of the right-wing faction of the Ba'ath Party and a Central Intelligence Agency asset was assigned the task of the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim. And on his third attempt, he was successful. That man was Saddam Hussein. And he's been their man in Baghdad for 27 years. And with the overthrow of the government of Abdul Karim Qasim, Saddam Hussein, under Central Intelligence Agency direction, was put in charge of what was called the Palace of the End. And tens of thousands of professors and students and trade union leaders and peasant figures and people who had been part of the national movement in Iraq were tortured murdered and disappeared. A bloodbath. It's not merely that Saddam Hussein was the operative. It's that he was run by the CIA station in Baghdad. And what was at work here was but the little continuation of what had occurred in Tehran, in Iran, in 1953, when a national revolution in Iran led to the coming to power of Mossadegh, who nationalized the oil in Iran. And that indeed brought about the Central Intelligence Agency putsch, which overthrew the government of Mossadegh in Iran and led to the creation of the Savak under the direction of the Mossad, the Israeli Mossad, and the Central Intelligence Agency. One of the most pervasive and deadly of secret police. The human toll at the hands of the Savak numbers in the multiple hundreds of thousands in the course of the reign of the Shah installed by the United States in 1953 in Iran. Well, brothers and sisters, every single administration in the United States since 1964 has had operational plans for the seizure, direct seizure, of oil in the Arab East. It has been a permanent feature of the operational planning of the ruling class in this country. And they've not been shy about articulating what it is that they had in mind. They described the area of the Arab littoral in the Gulf, including Mesopotamia, Iraq, as a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. They made plans in each administration, and in the course of making those plans, they spelled out what they required in order for them to be implemented. Robert Tucker, reflecting the plans that had been prepared in the National Security Council, published an article in Commentary in January 1975, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention. Without direct intervention and control, there is a distinct possibility of an economic and political disaster in the United States bearing more than a superficial resemblance to that of the 1930s. And in addressing the question of whether military intervention was feasible, he said, "We cannot intervene everywhere at once. So our intervention depends on identifying a relatively concentrated area of production where we can secure a sufficient portion of world oil production and proven reserves to break OPEC and to effect direct control." And it was in this piece that this area was called the Arab shoreline of the Gulf and the littoral, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. Harper's would then publish a piece called Seizing Arab Oil by Miles Ignotis, who was identified as a Pentagon consultant with intimate links to high-level U.S. policymakers. Miles Ignotis was Edward Luttwak, a long-standing Defense Intelligence Agency functionary. And what was set forth in 1975 was a blueprint for what would become Operation Desert Shield. We have developed rapid deployment and strike operational forces. The 82nd Airborne Division will lead the way with cavalry battalions, which will embark on giant C-5 and C-141 jet transports, refuel at Israeli bases, drop paratroopers at key locations in Saudi oil fields and in Iraq. Escort will be provided by squadrons of phantom fighters based on Israeli fields and carriers in the Arabian Gulf. A plan, codenamed Dahran Option 4, was prepared in the United States National Security Council, which called for direct U.S. attack on the oil fields of Iraq and the seizure of those oil fields. In August 1975, Oil Fields as a Military Objective, a Feasibility Study, prepared jointly by Colonel John Collins, Senior Specialist in National Defense, 18 years with contingency planning for the Pentagon, a detailed and elaborated military and operational plan. Indeed, by August 25, 1977, President Carter had issued a secret presidential directive, PD-18, which called for the increase in strike force of the operational military divisions required for, quote, rapid intervention in the Middle East and in the oil-producing areas of the Gulf of Saudi Arabia and of Iraq. By June 4, 1978, Admiral Thomas Moore, chairperson of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for the deployment of carriers to prepare for military operations. In 1979, Lawrence Mosher formulated the plan circulating in, quote, Pentagon and National Security Council corridors.
I'll give you an opportunity to get to your phones, 212-209-2950. Those of you who are used to listening to jazz at this time, this is a presentation that should jazz you up to get to the phone and support WBAI. It is this analysis that will help you in your organizing efforts, arm you with information, and get you out on the streets. March 20th, there are going to be big demonstrations. And aside from the visceral feelings of objecting to the war and the attacks and the assaults upon us daily that we experience in our lives and that our friends and our family and our coworkers are experiencing, it's important to understand the history and the dynamics and to be able to express it so that you can convince other people that they too should join with us. 212-209-2950. Treason at the Top. It's a very special premium. As I mentioned before, we can't hear all the phones ringing, and we're used to having you fill up those lines. Our Taking Aim listeners, those of you we've been able to reach through the WBAI website to let you know that we're on the air now, or those to whom you've seen our email messages, this is the time for you to come forward, 212-209-2950. Your contributions make a difference. As you know, Taking Aim is one of the programs that helps sustain WBAI. So everyone is depending upon you. We hear from you often about how much you appreciate the show, and now is the moment you can let us let the station know how much you appreciate WBAI for bringing you Taking Aim. Any amount. Credit cards are accepted, debit cards for your through bank deferred payments, and checks and money orders. 212-209-2950, Treason at the Top. Ralph?
Well, I want to urge everyone to support this broadcasting, and we've been attempting in the Treason at the Top to illuminate who rules and the ways in which this criminal ruling class manipulates our people through controlled media and through sustained lies. One of the important aspects of this reality in an election year is to understand the one big property party with two names. I did an article at the time of the election campaign of Walter Mondale, the Liberal Democrat, and Ronald Reagan, called Sex, Lies, and Electoral Dysfunction. And at that time, I sought to explain and to illuminate who really controls these two parties.
And Brown, Sex, Lies, and Electoral Dysfunction was at the time of Bill Clinton. Okay, go ahead.
That was the elucidation of what had occurred in the Mondale campaign by way of understanding.
Right. Go ahead.
During the presidential campaign of Walter Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro, Nation authors Thomas Ferguson and Joel Rogers disclosed on October 6, 1984, quote, leading investment bankers are the main contributors to the Democratic Party. Substantial funds were obtained from the partners and executives of Lehman Brothers, Kern Loeb, Goldman Sachs, Brown Brothers Harriman, Lazard Frere, and Prudential Bosch. Quote, A virtual first mortgage on the Mondale candidacy has been taken out by investment bankers, insurance company executives, and the business elites, for whom any cut in the deficit or in military spending is a threat to their interests. This essentially conservative group makes up the elite core of the Mondale campaign. Now, we were being, in that period, enjoined everywhere to support the liberal Democrat against the right-winger Ronald Reagan, who was going to threaten the United States with right-wing policies, which indeed he implemented upon election. But the essential thing to understand is that the Mondale and Reagan camps illuminated the same policymakers. The chief counselors on foreign policy to Walter Mondale were James Schlesinger and Max Kampelman. Both accompanied Mondale for his briefings by the director of the National Security Council. James Schlesinger was the consultant to the investment house of Shearson Lehman American Express. His views on the deficit of the day were identical to those of Ronald Reagan. Not unlike, with rhetoric notwithstanding, the positions of the Democrats today vis-a-vis George Bush. Let's take a quick look at the career of James Schlesinger. He was director of the Strategic Studies Program of the RAND Corporation. He was senior staff member advising John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson from 1963 through 1999, specifically with respect to the conduct of the war in Vietnam. He was director of the Bureau of the Budget under Richard Nixon in 1969. He was Richard Nixon's co-director of Office of Management of Budget in 1971. Schlesinger served Richard Nixon as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. When Nixon resigned, Schlesinger carried on as director of the Central Intelligence Agency under Gerald Ford in 1973, and then as Secretary of Defense. James Schlesinger was a flexible man. He directed Ronald Reagan's challenge to General Ford's nomination in 1976. When Ford won the nomination but lost to the presidency of Jimmy Carter, while James Schlesinger was appointed personal assistant for security to President Carter. Carter then appointed him Secretary of the Department of Energy from 1977 to 79. As Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, Schlesinger was, quote, more hawkish than Nixon, unquote. He advocated first strike strategy and became the senior director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University, where he divided his time between preparing strategy for the Pentagon and financial policy for Shearman Lehman American Express. Now, what about the other principal advisor in national security to the liberal Democrat, Walter Mondale? It was Max Kampelman. Max Kampelman's relationship to Mondale antedated that of Schlesinger. Indeed, he served on the Council for Hubert Humphrey from 49 to 55, was Lyndon Johnson's advisor to the security agency for Vietnam policy, and oversaw the most intensive saturation bombing of Vietnam. But more than that, he was in the right-wing Atlantic Council of the U.S. from 65 to 70. He was founder of the, quote, Committee on the Present Danger. Now, the Committee on the Present Danger was tied to the World Anti-Communist League, which included neo-fascists and far-right military commanders such as General John Singlov. His Committee on the Present Danger advocated assassination and direct military intervention. The Committee on the Present Danger is the antecedent of the neocons, the PNAC, Wolfowitz, and Pearl. All of these figures have their origins in the groups directed by Kampelman. They included Midge Decker, Norman Podhoretz, Leon Kaiserling, Jean Kirkpatrick, Richard Pipes. Pipes was Reagan's chief advisor on the Soviet Union. The beat goes on, brothers and sisters. This is one big property party with two names. This is the apparatus of control of a capitalist ruling class. It is soft cop, hard cop. It is a con designed to entice disaffection into the ranks of their corporate-controlled political apparatus, no less then than it is now in 2004, taking aim is about elucidating this reality and demonstrating what we need to know to build the alternative, to prepare for the struggles ahead, to create a party based on working people that expresses our interests. The bosses have two parties. We need one of our own.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Rao Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Tonight, we're presenting Treason at the Top. 212-209-2950 for your contribution to WBAI. And this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. We're going to be with you until 11:30 tonight, when there will be Robert Knights coming on with election coverage. Now, we want to also play some excerpts of Treason at the Top that we haven't played before, particularly Ralph's presentations about the underlying politics of 9/11. And so we're going to go to that very soon. But I want to remind you of some of the programs that we presented over the past number of months, such as Buried Alive, Torture in America, about the Supermax prisons, or Vision of Hell, the unspeakable torment of other species. Who are the Butchers of Baghdad? Who killed Kennedy and why was a very special premium that was presented for a WBAI fund drive. Assassins Are Us, Vietnam Meets Iraq. Edwin T. Wilson and the Merchants of Death, or Outing the Gentlemen Killers of the CIA, which was a two-part program, and Setting Up the Saudis. Smoking Guns of 9/11 and 9/11 and the Capitalist State. Libyan Lockerbie, The Untold Story. These are only programs that we've presented since September of 2003. It's a very long list, as those of you who listen to Taking Aim realize. Target Africa, we did two-part series. Crony Capitalism, a three-part series. All of this is brought to you over WBAI, and it is WBAI depends upon you to sustain this type of programming. 212-209-2950 for the Treason at the Top, which you're going to want to listen to over and again and share with your friends and family. So now let's go to a portion of Treason at the Top that we haven't played before. And I know that after listening to this, you're going to really say, this is a program I have to have in my library. Tita?
Operation Northwoods. There has never been a major imperial war in this country which was not prepared for by pretexts of this nature. From Remember the Maine to the sinking of the Lusitania, to Pearl Harbor itself, to the hidden history of the Korean War with the special forces raids continuously on North Korea, entrapping and entrancing the response of the Koreans, to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, Operation Northwoods, but the little continuation. On the anniversary of September 11th, Richard Bernstein in the New York Times provided an account of how Mohammed Atta had met Ramzi Youssef, a key recruit for the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. And the article labels the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center the linchpin of September 11th. And it stated that Mohammed Atta was designated as the boss of the September 11 attacks in preparation for the 1993 operation. I wrote a piece in 1993 called Who Bombed the World Trade Center? Growing Evidence Points to the Role of FBI Operative. What happened in 1993? We were informed that the attack on the World Trade Center was prepared by the blind Egyptian cleric. And that's rather interesting, because that particular individual had been part of Operation Cyclone in Egypt of the Central Intelligence Agency. But we find that the person who organized the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, Imad Ali Salem, was not only an Egyptian intelligence agent, but a long-standing and current operative of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Imad Ali Salem, under FBI direction, proposed the bombing, prepared it, recruited people to it, funded it, and on the basis of this provocation, in every single meeting, he wore a wire, and he transcribed the results of that wired series of meetings And each transcript and document was put in the offices of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for 6 months, 50 file cabinet drawers of boxes of recorded documents of the meetings of this operative preparing for the bombing of the World Trade Center. Here are some of the other plans that were advanced by this FBI operative under the direction of the FBI in New York City: blowing up the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, the Statue of Liberty, and George Washington Bridge. And then we learned that the person who organized the safe house, who financed the hiring of the Ryder rental van, was one Guzi Hadass, a Mossad operative. And the Israeli intelligence agency communique of Matara had all of this. This has been in the New York Times, the Village Voice, the Los Angeles Times, the Dallas Times Herald. This was an intelligence operation. The bombing of the World Trade Center. These are what we call false flag operations. Within minutes of the blowing up of the World Trade Center on 9/11, we were being told that this was the work of one Osama bin Laden. Of course, Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmet Yar had been the recipients of $6 billion from the Central Intelligence Agency to create a network, a terror network, yes, in Afghanistan, but not just in Afghanistan. As Brzezinski himself acknowledged, these people were put into motion in the then Central Asian republics of the Soviet Union to destabilize those governments and to draw, as Brzezinski described it in his chapter in his book, The Grand Chessboard, the bear trap, to draw the Russians into Afghanistan. This was the genesis of what became Al-Qaeda. The Taliban itself, a creation of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, under the direction of a man named Gul Hamid, the head of the ISI. Well, Gul Hamid gave an extraordinary interview to Arno de Borsgrave in the aftermath of 9/11. Arno de Borsgrave, who was the former editor of Newsweek, the Washington Times, and now the director of the United Press International. And in this detailed interview, Gul Hamid said, look, this is a U.S. Air Force intelligence and Mossad operation. Let me tell you, you guys trained me. I can tell you how it's done. He says, you simply created the basis for plans that have been on your drawing boards for a long time. And it's an elaborated description of the stand down outside of Washington, D.C., when no planes were scrambled. It's an account by an insider of the nature of the operation. General Mahmoud replaced Gul Hamid. He was in Washington, D.C., in meetings in the State Department and the National Security Council just prior to and during 9/11. He wired $100,000 into the account of Mohammed Atta. And when this was documented and disclosed, not only in the Hindustani Times, but in the British press and in the French press, well, General Mahmoud was quietly retired. What are we looking at here? David Weiss, an author who specializes in writing about U.S. intelligence operations, notably what he calls false flag operations, which are run by the Central Intelligence Agency, did an extended critique in the Los Angeles Times called Omens of Terror. And he describes preparations in U.S. intelligence agencies for airlines to strike at American targets. And he specifies three distinct plans and plots to use, and I'm quoting from the Los Angeles Times, airplanes as flying bombs to target buildings and people, operations prior to the September 11th attacks. Well, who are these people to whom these events are being imputed? Mohammed Atta and his associates. The Washington Post, Newsweek, and Knight Ridder newspapers have established that they were, quote, trained at high-level U.S. military facilities. Newsweek. U.S. military sources have confirmed that five of the terrorists, including Mohammed Atta, were cleared through with cryptic security clearances and trained at secure U.S. military installations. Mohammed Atta was trained in the International Officers School at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. Abdulaziz Al-Amari received his training at the Aerospace School at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. Saeed Ahmadi did the Defense and Language Institute in Monterey, California. Newsweek's George Beritz, Catherine Skip, and John Barry concluded five of these hijackers used in Tuesday's terror attacks received their full training at secure U.S. military installations. And the deputy chair, Stephen Butler, of the Monterey Language School of the Defense Intelligence Agency, wrote a memorandum in which he said, George Bush, you are responsible for the events of 9/11. You have required us to prepare and to train the people deployed in that event. This man was forced to resign. He has stood by his memorandum. It is a small particle of the mass of evidence that shows the hands of intelligence in every aspect of this false flag operation, the World Trade Center, and the attack on the Pentagon. In our broadcasts on Taking Aim, we did a five-hour presentation called The World Trade Center Uncensored History, and we have a one-hour presentation called 9/11 False Flag Operation, in which we go through step by step with the documentation, the mechanics of this operation, what it required, who are the personnel, what are the dates in which they had their meetings and their instructions, their relationship to the Israeli intelligence services, the 200 Israeli spies who were operational in the United States, the role of the Urban Van Moving Company that was positioned outside the World Trade Center, photographing it for a half day before the strike, detained by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, these operatives featured in Frontline and on ABC television, the four-part series in Fox News about the role of the Mossad, 60 agents located in Hollywood, Florida, in constant contact with Mohammed Atta since Hamburg, a safe house two doors down from where Mohammed Atta was living. And by the way, where was he living? He was living in the home of Charlie Voss, an employee of Rudy Decker and Arno Kriethoff's flight school in Venice, Florida. Charlie Voss is a Central Intelligence Agency Contra operative involved in the CIA Contra runs in Nicaragua during the time of the Nicaraguan Revolution. Obviously, the logical place for the putative hijacker to be lodged. The hands of intelligence are all over this operation. This is a false flag operation. The American people are being terrorized, all right. It is state terrorism. It is the terror of our rulers with their orange alerts, with their constant litany about every minute we're going to be attacked. Yes? Why, the terrorists talk about your ultimate conspiracy theory. More powerful than 50,000 hydrogen bomb missiles, more dangerous than the Soviet Union. It's Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. All 200 of his little operatives, yes, who can't break wind without it being registered on the promise hardware, as the Central Intelligence Agency has made clear, every movement these people have made, registered on their spy satellites, every communication they've ever attempted, their numbers wholly permeated by the operatives of U.S. intelligence. How do you sell to the American people permanent war, the wiping out of the budget surplus, the trillions of dollars that are disappearing, the wholesale attack on our social services, our health care, our education, a series of permanent wars? How do you sell that to our people except through the 2001 version of Operation Northwoods, brothers and sisters? We are in the presence of a ruthless ruling class. And it is essential that in our mobilizing and in the movement that we build, we do not attempt to outflank the Bush men from the right, that we don't talk about increasing the danger of terror and play into the hands of these people. We have to attack head on the fiction of 9/11, the category of terror, the nature of this power. The longer you con people, the madder they are when they find it out. Our people are able to understand this, bring the evidence to bear, make it part of our resistance, because this is a serious struggle for survival of our freedoms, because the detention camps that Maya will describe, the Operation Garden plots, the Patriot Acts, the home security, the plans to seize the hospitals, to seize the food distribution points, to detain masses of people in the United States under military tribunals with the total elimination of the normal due process and civil liberties and democratic rights that are the result of a revolution in the 18th century, brothers and sisters. That is what is at stake here. This anti-war struggle is a struggle against our own oppression in this country. It is a struggle for power, ultimately. It is a task that requires us to build a political instrument that can wrest power from these people, that breaks with the political parties, the one big property party with two names that are the vehicle for our oppression. Nothing short of that. We have to not just speak truth to power, but we have to arm our people with the information that enables them to move forward. Because this is not a rabble. This populace has never, this working class has never suffered a generalized defeat in this country. They are organized at the point of production in their trade unions. They are capable of resistance. And I am confident that they will meet that test, rise to that occasion, when they are provided with the information that enables them to see these ruthless rulers for what they are. Thank you.
You are listening to Treason at the Top. I'm Maya Schoen and
Ralph Schoenman.
And Treason at the Top is our premium, our gift to you for your donation to WBAI of $100, 212-209-2950. Get on the phone. This is the last opportunity. We're on until 11:30 tonight, and then that's it for Treason at the Top. And we know that this is a program that you are going to want to share with your friends, your family, your colleagues. You're going to want to listen to over and over again. It is so full of information. And once again, we prepared a very special program for you. 212-209-2950. We hope those of you will also be with us next week. We're going to be on from 7 until 9 p.m. with another special program called Testing the Waters, Military Rule in America. Now, in Treason at the Top, you've heard excerpts from Ralph's presentation, small excerpts. It's over an hour presentation that he makes. And then I have a presentation for about 45 minutes about the assault on workers in the United States, both in terms of the economy and also the abrogation of our civil liberties. Recently, there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, "New Rules Make FBI Spy Agency, Criminal Intelligence Agents Work Side by Side." And what it quotes the FBI Chief John Pistole, who said in an interview, quote, "With 9/11 as the catalyst, what we've done is fundamentally change the approach we're going to take to every counterterrorism case. This is a sea change for the FBI." But what the Chronicle notes, in quoting Dan Egan from the Washington Post, that civil libertarians and defense lawyers see the changes that are going on right now with the FBI as a threat to privacy, due process of civilians, because they eliminate rather than nearly blur the traditional boundaries that separate criminal and intelligence investigations. And that is one of the many changes that are going on behind closed doors. In other words, the FBI, the CIA, and all under the auspices of new guidelines that also are taking place in the Justice Department and under the mantle of the Department of Homeland Security, what they're doing is whittling away the protections in terms of our civil liberties. This is one thing that we discuss in Treason at the Top. What is the basis for this? Why are they doing this? And how can they do this at this moment? And again, we also discuss in Treason at the Top the resistance, our resistance, because it's only with our organized resistance that we can capture the state, that we can have a country that is our own and not the treasonous, ruling class, the corporate elite and the finance capital, the military-industrial complex, and those who rule in their name. Ralph?
You know, in illuminating the role of both parties in this crisis of ours, this system that is in a terminal decay, and I emphasize this, brothers and sisters, because to the very extent that we are being treated to the prospect of permanent war, what they call World War IV, as articulated by James Woolsey, and Woolsey, I have to remind people, was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency under William Clinton, Bill Clinton. Woolsey, who is one of the architects of the theme of World War IV, of preventive or preemptive war, targeting no less than 61 countries. These are the very figures who were associated previously with the Democratic Party and the administration of Clinton, and are now amongst the so-called neocons, or the advocates and the supporters of permanent war and permanent militarization of our own society. It's evocative of the following, because I have to remind people that in 1972, George McGovern opposed Richard Nixon as a peace candidate and used the rhetoric to co-opt the anti-war movement and to channel it into the ranks of the Democratic Party, much as Dennis Kucinich has told us that his main task is to create a great umbrella for the people who are disaffected from U.S. policy, a great corporate umbrella. Look at the record of George McGovern, who was presenting himself to the American people as a candidate against war. He voted in the Senate for the specific defense appropriations for Vietnam in 1966, Bill number 665, and again in 1967, Bill number 7123, and for a $7 billion increase to the Department of Defense, including Vietnam appropriations in 1968, that was Bill 3293, and again in 1969, Bill 11400. All these bills specify specific funds for operations in Vietnam, and he supported in the same period 8 additional supplemental allocations demanded by the Pentagon for the war in Vietnam. George McGovern voted against allowing drafted soldiers to be represented by a lawyer before the draft board. He supported an amendment making it an offense to travel or telephone across state lines to, quote, incite a riot, unquote, which was the standard device for suppressing freedom of speech, travel of association, and the anti-war demonstrations of the period. And he supported this in 1968, H.R. 2516. McGovern voted to disqualify from public employment for 5 years persons convicted of crimes related to riot. 1968, riot defined as the massive anti-war demonstrations. He voted to allocate $400 million to the police for wiretapping and surveillance of anti-war demonstrators. 1969 and 1970, S-1917. He voted to cite an anti-war leader, Jeff Fort, for contempt of Congress because Fort refused to cooperate with investigators. This was in 1968. McGovern voted to deprive universities of federal funds for students convicted of actions against an institution or substantial disruption, unquote. 1968, H.R. 18037, McGovern voted to extend the military draft for 4 years and in 1967, and in support of legislation compelling soldiers to serve in Southeast Asia, even if they requested assignment elsewhere, 1967, S-1432, McGovern voted against reducing military service for draftees from 2 years to 18 months. His record on labor was one of the worst. He voted against extending the period when people over 65 could receive medical benefits in 1967. He voted against increasing Social Security benefits by 20%. He voted against eliminating anti-union legislation, which outlawed trade union shops. He voted to extend the prohibition against a railroad strike in 1967 and to first extend the prohibition by 47 days again in 1967, etc. The beat goes on. The liberal candidate, the anti-war candidate, the progressive candidate for the Democratic Party in 1972, George McGovern. Will we never learn? It is the same old, same old. These are con people, brothers and sisters. These are the instruments of the ruling parties. We need to build a political instrument of our own. We need a party based on labor, on the trade unions, on working people, on the most oppressed, on our black workers, on our Latino workers, a political instrument of our own. The longer we wait, the longer it takes.
And we need a strong, viable radio station broadcasting throughout the tri-state region of New York and on the Internet throughout the world. People have written to us from Thailand, from Costa Rica, saying how important WBAI is to them and how important it is that they're able to hear Taking Aim each week. That is because of you, the listener. 212-209-2950. Your contribution. Become a member of WBAI and help sustain it. 212-209-2950. There are wonderful volunteers at this late hour in the pledge room waiting to take your telephone calls. Let those phones light up. Let's hear every one of those phones lit up and let's make this an incredible fun drive evening. 212-209-2950 for your contribution of $100. We offer you Treason at the Top, two CDs. For those of you who have audio cassette players, it's time to upgrade to the new era of CDs. And these are fully tracked, so you can stop and start and skip around, and they're very high-quality audio CDs from a duplicating house. 212-209-2950, Treason at the Top. And we hope you'll join with us next week for another special program, which will be Testing the Waters. Again, we will not be on at our standard time, 5 to 6. We're going to be on from 7 to 9, enabling you to get home from work and to take notes and to join with us for 2 hours. And that is only possible because of your contributions to WBAI. 212-209-2950. Tonight we also want to play another section from my presentation, one that you haven't heard before. And then also we're going to go to the question and answer period and to play some of questions and answers you haven't heard before. But in order to get the full continuity of Treason at the Top, and again, I want to remind you, this is a program that someone here in San Francisco thought was so important that he's been broadcasting it day after day and time after time over a low-power radio station. And he said that it really opened his eyes, and he wanted other people to have the same understanding. And you too might be able to share it with your friends, your families, and your colleagues. Gather a group of people around, listen to it together, have a discussion, particularly an analysis, questions and answers. You can contact us if you have any questions afterwards at our phone number in Vallejo, 707-552-9995, or write to us at takingaim@wbai.org or at Taking Aim, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. But most of all, remember you can also call the station, talk to Fred at the switchboard, and he will put you in contact with us. And Fred is one of the many people, T-Dub, the engineer tonight, who came in, is one of the staff people that maintain WBAI. And it takes many, many people to keep this station on the air. the operating expenses for this station are very large. Not large compared to the commercial stations, because we have so many people who volunteer, such as ourselves, who donate their labor in order to bring all this wonderful programming to you. Many volunteers and a true core staff. And it is up to us to maintain the staff. We rely upon them. They're precious to us. 212-209-2950. Remember, this is your station, WBAI.
And keep the funds coming and keep the funds going to where they're required and where they should be going, which is to sustain the programming, to maintain the staff, to maintain the engineers, to prevent people from being laid off, and to make certain that those who have dedicated themselves to making WBAI a functioning station are kept doing just that. That's the purpose of the fundraising. That should be the direction to which the funds are sent.
And remember that the WBAI has a goal that must be met, and this goal is not an arbitrary goal. The goal that is set for the fund drive is the amount of funds that are necessary to sustain WBAI. Every day when you turn on television, whether it's cable television or whether it's regular network television, you are bombarded every few minutes with a commercial for one corporate product or another. Here on WBAI, we don't do that. Every few months, we must come forward, but we also prepare special programming for you as a thank you gift for your contributions, your sustaining of this station and the entire Pacifica network. This goes on at all the stations in the Pacifica network. 212-209-2950. And our gift to you is Treason at the Top for your $100 contribution, checks, credit cards, money orders, or bank debits. Now we're going to go to a part of the presentation, of my presentation. It's the last part of it, and we'll be back with you again for more discussion and presentation. Ralph has been compiling a lot of information today, and we'll be discussing that with you. But during this time, remember that you can dial 212-209-2950. This is your last opportunity. Don't wake up tomorrow and say, you know, I should have gotten Treason at the Top. It's going to be too late. Do it today. Remember, do it now. Get to the phone, 212-209-2950. Heat up.
On March 14th, just a few days ago, Attorney General John Ashcroft, it was noted in the New York Times that with the consolidation with the Homeland Security and the consolidation that's been taking place in the Justice Department out of sight, that the Justice Department has expanded its street presence to spy on ordinary Americans, read their email messages, their library checkouts, as I said. But also, what has been done through the Justice Department is the registration of immigrants from 34 countries. The registration, also the imprisonment of people who are fleeing to this country and ask for asylum. They are now, the people who are fleeing, and by the way, the country from which the largest number of asylum seekers come is Iraq. These people will now be imprisoned until their hearings are finished. And sometimes this can take over a year. These are the asylum seekers. Give us your tired, your poor. You come to this country seeking asylum, and you are to be imprisoned. You come to this country from the Middle Eastern country. You must be fingerprinted. You must register. And if you are Iraqi and you are male, you are probably going to be interrogated because 10,000 Iraqis are having someone knock on their door in these days as we sit here to be interrogated by the Justice Department. Another aspect that happened after 9/11. Ralph spoke of the supposed anthrax scare that was, if you remember first, they said that the anthrax was a result of Osama bin Laden. And then they said that the anthrax was the result of Saddam Hussein. And as Ralph mentioned, scientists throughout this country and in England started looking at the anthrax spores. And what they discovered, much to the distaste of our rulers, is that the anthrax that was in letter to Tom Daschle's office and to other congressional offices was of such a refined strain, what they call militarized anthrax, it could only be produced at either Battelle Memorial in Ohio, which is the very laboratory that contracts out to the Central Intelligence Agency, or at the U.S. AMRID, which is Fort Detrick, and which, by the way, has been the source of sending out anthrax to countries throughout the world, wherever it is sent. Most of the time, it is sent by U.S. AMRID, by the United States government. At that time, at Georgetown and Johns Hopkins University, a group met, and they prepared the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And they did this for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And it says right here on the document, which I brought, and afterwards, if you want to look at, you can read the entire document, or scan through it, rather. It says, to assist the National Governors Association, the National Conference of State Legislators, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and the National Association of County and City Health Officials. This Model State Emergency Powers Act was to be the model for which state after state legislature was to adopt. And the Bush administration made it very clear that funding was dependent to the states for public health emergencies was dependent upon passage of either this act or an act that was similar to it. But what is so critical in these Model State Health Powers Act, and state after state already has acts of how to deal with public health emergencies, because, for instance, in California, where we have many earthquake faults, it is a possibility that there will be public health emergencies as a result of an earthquake. So the state legislatures plan for this. But what is different about this act that was crafted and which was the intent to have passed is that it gives the governor, and solely the governor, taking everything away from the state legislatures, the ability to essentially declare martial law on the premise that there might be a health emergency. And these emergency powers, state specifically, he can suspend any regulatory statute that prescribes procedures for conducting state business and that would prevent or hinder his public health authority. He can mobilize the organized militia into the service of the state. He can transfer the direction, the personnel, and the functions of state departments in order to facilitate response and recovery. In other words, it gives full powers to the governor to control whatever happens in the state. It also says that he can take over the hospitals and direct what is to take place in the hospital, that they control the modes of transportation and the ingress and egress throughout the state. And above all, they can declare that people must have inoculations that they consider essential, and that if you refuse, you are to be quarantined. That is, you are to be essentially imprisoned for refusing to be inoculated. This is the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And as we speak, in the California State Legislature, they are debating a Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that is modeled upon what was produced at Johns Hopkins University. It is also under consideration in New York, where you have the medical profession and you have lawyers trying to beat it back, but to date they have not been successful. I want to leave us time for questions and answer, but there is one more attack that I think we really need to discuss. Aside from the wiretaps, the Model Health Emergency, the use of the Army and the other military to try to control dissent, and that again has to do with TIPS, the plan that they tried to institute in the United States, which is to pit neighbor against neighbor, and to pit, particularly it was the UPS delivery people and the postal workers against each and every one of us. In other words, it was to say that each and every one of us should be a spy against our friends, our families, our colleagues, that everyone was suspect. You're either with us or you're against us. That's what they're saying. You're with us or you're against us. We know that that's not the way to operate. And fortunately, the Postal Workers Union in the United States, as a union, refused to accept TIPS. And I want to end with that because, again, this really shows the strength of United Action. If there had not been a postal workers union that could say to the government, we are not the spy apparatus, you cannot use us in this way. If the postal workers were not unionized and they were atomized workers, individual workers who would lose their job if they so much had said, I refuse to do this. Well, you're fired, because if you're not in a union and you don't have a contract, you can be fired for any reason, just because your boss, your supervisor doesn't like you. They do not have to really give a reason. If it were not for this postal workers union, TIPS would be here today. And that is what I'd like to end on. It's the collective action, the organization, the importance in our anti-war demonstrations to try to build the strongest coalitions. What we have going on in the media today is a vociferous attempt to undermine whatever unity we build with our coalitions, to try to discredit one organization as opposed to another, to try to undermine the big coalitions, and even to undermine our mass demonstrations. What you had the other week is Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, trying to pit the mass mobilizations and the taking of the streets blocking traffic, trying to say that that was taking away money from social services. We have to say to Willie Brown, to President Bush, to every one of our congressmen, you are not expressing reality. What we are doing is the correct, the only step to take. It is our united action, and everyone here I know has participated in that united action. It's bigger and wider. Every one of us has been armed today with information. Every one of us can go out and speak to people here throughout the country and throughout the world. Every one of us is a mobilizer. Every one of us can build unity. And every one of us is an important element in stopping this war, in stopping this genocidal government. And every one of us is a link in creating a government that represents our interests, a government that expresses our desires, meets our needs, and is truly democratic. Thank you.
You've been listening to Treason at the Top. That's a small excerpt from the presentation I made about the assaults on the working people, the assaults on our civil liberties, the assault on our economic sustenance. And you've also heard excerpts from Ralph's more than 1 hour presentation that includes the longstanding plans to capture Iraq, the history of their use of biological and chemical weapons, why 9/11 was an essential move on the part of a sector of the ruling class, and was the basis for the attack on our civil liberties. I also discuss in my presentation military operations other than war, building of the martial law here in the United States, which is going to be, again, the focus of our program next week, our two-hour special. And above all, we both address why the Democratic Party is not a viable option for our support, as Ralph gave you a history lesson before about Mondale and also McGovern. For those of you who were born after 1970, it's important to understand that it's the same old as what we're witnessing tonight with the Democratic Party primaries. Ralph?
I want to emphasize that as we explain in Treason at the Top, all of the people to whom responsibility was attributed for the events of 9/11, the so-called team of terrorists, are people who have a long-standing and documented history of direction and involvement with American intelligence.
Before you do that, Ralph, because I know you're going to present such dynamic information, I want to remind people to dial 212-209-2950 if the line is busy, because before all the phone lines were lit up. If the line is busy, please stay on and try and try and try again. Your contributions are critical, and Ralph is going to present important information, and we keep on presenting this information week after week because of you, because you sustain the station, and we are able to make presentations week after week on Taking Aim. 212-209-2950. As I said, this is your last opportunity for Treason at the Top, and it is a program you are definitely going to want to have in your library. Ralph.
Well, almost a day, no day fails to pass without some passing reference to the terrorists, and again reiterating the theme that Mohammed Atta and his colleagues had been part of a very sophisticated and elaborated plan in preparation for years to coordinate the multiple attacks upon the World Trade Center and on the Pentagon, leaving aside the fact that the collapse of the Pentagon can in no way be attributed to the impact of those airplanes or the resulting fire, as physicist Jim Hoffman has amply documented. The hydrocarbon fire that is responsible, supposedly on the government's allegation for the collapse of the towers, is simply incapable not only of melting the steel, but of resulting in the total pulverization into dust, not even particles, but dust, of the massive tons of concrete and of glass. But with respect to the putative hijackers, from the beginning it's been very apparent that there not only was no connection between these particular individuals and these events, but that their real involvement was with U.S. Intelligence and military authorities themselves. Mohammed Atta was established in Washington Post, Newsweek, and Knight Ridder newspapers, along with six of the supposed terrorists to have been trained at high-level U.S. military facilities. And as we've reported and have documented frequently, Newsweek had to acknowledge that, quote, U.S. military sources confirmed that six of the terrorists, including Mohammed Atta, were cleared through and trained at secure military installations. I still quote, Mohammed Atta was trained at the International Officers School at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. Abdulaziz Alamari received his training at the Aerospace School at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. Saeed Ahmadi attended the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. These people, all of them accused now of being terrorists, had given their address for contact at the Pensacola Naval Air Station. They were cleared through the U.S. Air Force International Officers School. In fact, the conclusion of Newsweek's George Refritz, Catherine Skip, and John Barry was that the alleged hijackers of the plane used in Tuesday's terror attacks received their training at secure U.S. military installations and were under direction, unquote. And the BBC correspondent Tom Carver had reported on October 11, 2002, that the United States, based upon the imputation of the events of 9/11 to these, quote, terrorists, unquote, was deploying the military for targeting the entire Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, based upon plans, operational plans in place prior to the events of 9/11 themselves. And in that regard, let us make a particular reference to the Newsweek documentation of the whereabouts of Mohammed Atta after September 11th. In an interview with his father in Cairo, Mohammed Atta's father stated that he had received a telephone call on September 12th from his son, Mohammed Atta. He was emphatic in stating that the Mohammed Atta, who was his son, had no connection with Islamic fundamentalism, had long rejected such ideas, had continued associations with, quote, friendly governments, unquote, and that not only had he heard from his son on September 12th, but that subsequently he had learned that his son had been killed by the Mossad to conceal his actual identity and role. And that is amplified by information that many investigators, including Daniel Hofziger, have unfolded regarding Mohammed Atta having worked for U.S. and German governmental programs for at least 4 years while living in Hamburg during the 1990s.
Ralph, I'm going to interrupt you to remind folks that 212-209-2950 is the telephone number, brothers and sisters, to be dialing right now. 212-209-2950. You know, we come to you each week from the studios at KPFA, and there is an engineer there. There's an engineer at WBAI. Kathy Davis, the public affairs director, facilitates the phone transmission so that we can have high-quality audio, not like the telephone that we're on right now. And this takes a station. This takes all of the people at the various, at the KPFA, at WBAI, so that we can be with you, so that over and over again you can hear deeper and deeper analysis as we peel the layers off of the onion and then also give politics of 9/11, not just the dynamics, the dynamics of why it takes place, how it fits into history, how it explains what is going on now. Over the months, you know, Ralph, in October of 2001, there was the five-hour presentation, World Trade Center Uncensored History. On what station other than WBAI can you get uninterrupted programming 5 hours long? And then 9/11 in the capitalist state and the smoking guns of 9/11 we did this year in September at the time of 9/11. And 9/11 false flag operation, the seminal program we did that synthesized so much in September of 2002. And foreknowledge of 9/11, a two-hour presentation, which reminds me of one of our past WBAI premiums about pretext and foreknowledge relating to not just events of 9/11, but pretext used throughout the years, and also pretexts that are used by the Zionists for their for their devastation of the Palestinian people. We haven't been speaking tonight about all the programming we've done about the hidden history of Zionism, about Zionism unmasked, the meaning and logistics of transfer, about the genocide taking place, massacre, the linchpin of Zionist policies, and over again the various programming. I'm going to return to Ralph in a moment, but first, again, I want to remind you, brothers and sisters, this is your last opportunity. We have 1.5 hour more of programming. This is it. Treason at the Top, 212-209-2950. We know, Taking AIM listeners, and Ralph and I, we feel like a very large community, a community that keeps growing. Your calls are wonderful. We know you appreciate the programming. We know that you're doing all you can. And please think about it and try to do a little bit more. 212-209-2950. Those of you who are doing well economically, this is the moment to come forward, sustain Taking AIM, sustain WBAI, make your generous contribution. 212-209-2950. And all of you, I can't say enough about how networking really makes a difference. Each and every one of us, if we would contact 5 people and say to those people, become a member of WBAI, and then those people, when they're devoted WBAI listeners, they contact each and every one of them, 5 people, the WBAI listenership will grow into the millions. There are over 14 million people in the New York region, and WBAI reaches out to the world through the Internet. Think of all the people who could be sustaining WBAI and bringing ever-increasing quality to our programming. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the role of Muhammad Atta is just really the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the extraordinary documentation that has emerged has demonstrated that throughout the time that Muhammad Atta that has been surfaced by the intelligence agencies was in Hamburg, as exposed by the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, the largest newspaper in Germany, on October 18, 2001, under the heading Atta was supported by German organizations. What is exposed here is that the Bundestag program, overseen by the U.S. State Department and the German Ministry of Economic Cooperation, was sustaining Muhammad Atta and his colleagues while they were in Hamburg. And then there is something called the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, described as the German International Further Education Organization. But what's interesting about this is that the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft was not just a private entity, but it was under the direction of the equivalent of the AID program in Germany, linked to the United States, and one of its directors was none other than Henry Kissinger. In fact, the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, which was sustaining Muhammad Atta and subsidizing his travel and maintaining him in Hamburg all the time he was supposedly plotting for the events of 9/11, the list of the power brokers involved in this operation included Kissinger and Rockefeller. On the board of this was not only Kissinger and Rockefeller, but Clinton and other Democratic heavyweights, such as Hillary Clinton and the Clinton White House advisor, Ira Magaziner. This is an extraordinary example of the ways in which we are deceived. The hand of intelligence is all over these putative operatives. Mohammed Atta was a, quote, engineer, but under the control of government operations, government agencies that were funding his presence at the very time when he was supposedly preparing the events of 9/11, monitored, controlled, directed. The Chicago Tribune documented that a specific couple associated with the Carl Duisberg Society, but within links to U.S. intelligence, had been the handlers of Mohammed Atta in Hamburg. Anywhere you touch this, brothers and sisters, the hand of our rulers is all over the events of 9/11.
Ralph, it's 11 o'clock, Masomenos. We missed the exact chime. But this is WBAI. I want to remind everybody, WBAI, New York, 99.5 on the dial, and www.wbai.org on the internet. This is Maya Schoen.
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program Taking Aim is heard on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Next week we're going to be on at 7 to 9 so that you can take notes and really get a handle on the testing the waters, military rule in America, which we think is very timely now with the considering what's going on in the electoral process and the attempts to steal elections, whether by hook or by crook or by computer.
The Washington Post, Maya, has set out explicitly what Bush stated in the State of the Union message, namely that a terrorist attack involving biological weapons is inevitable, and both, as I mentioned in the Wall Street Journal, General McCaffrey and then Tommy Franks, the general who was running the war in Iraq, in Cigar Aficionado, laid out the scenario in which an inevitable, inexorable terrorist attack on the United States in the election year will lead to the cancellation of elections and the imposition of martial law. They're signaling it to us, brothers and sisters. They're terrorizing us with this reality. They're preparing us for the removal of any formal democratic process in this society. Let's not be deluded by the Democratic Party candidates' blather. The realities are that they are all perfectly aware of this testing of the waters by the major military and intelligence figures in the United States. Congress supports their activity, sustains them with funds, votes for their Patriot Acts, and sustains with funds their budgets and their wars. And then come election time, they prattle about the interests of the many, as all the while that they are funded by those who sustain the power of the few.
Well, 212-209-2950, this is your last opportunity for Treason at the Top, which is a firm basis for listening to Testing the Waters next week. I want to play one particular question from the question and answer that addresses 9/11, Ralph, and then we'll come back for more discussion about 9/11. But before we do so, something was sent to me today referring to an internet news site in the Netherlands, which is talking about the training terrorists for a coup in Venezuela, and training in the USA terror tactics at the U.S. Army School of the Americas, which has been renamed and is now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation at Fort Benning, Georgia. And that bringing up Henry Kissinger, the reason that reminded me of this is that all this week there have been meetings, top-level meetings, with strategists from the Venezuelan political opposition in Washington with none other than Henry Kissinger, and the Venezuelan billionaire who would fund all this, Gustavo Cisneros. So we'll be discussing Venezuela in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, Treason at the Top, and we'll return with Ralph discussing more of 9/11. 212-209-2950. T-Dub, let's go to the CD.
Yeah, hi. Just as a way of getting you to restate something that, you know, your statement about the nature of the 9/11 attacks, I was going to, you know, I'm very receptive to what you've stated. Some of this is new information, although I've heard similar things from other sources. But before I started to be receptive to that, I was thinking that, well, why wasn't it an attack from outside the United States, from one of the many victims of our empire building all over the world? Why isn't this an example of what Chalmers Johnson calls blowback? And he's written a book that I'm in the middle of reading about right now. I was thinking that this did come from outside the United States, but our government knew about it and allowed it to happen. Now you're presenting quite a different view, and so if you could just address it from there.
Yes, there are many people who have attempted to look at this evidence and to speak of what is called blowback, and blowback means that because of the policies of the United States in the Middle East, there's been a reaction to those policies, and people have been alienated by the policies of the United States, which is what spurred this terrorist apparatus. And the problem, in my judgment, with that is it gives credence to this whole fiction about the terror network that is out there. You know, Al-Qaeda is a Central Intelligence Agency construct and creation. Without doubt, there are fundamentalist religious groups that have been alienated by U.S. imperial policies because of their own particular theocratic convictions and what have you, but they're totally penetrated and totally infiltrated, and they were orchestrated and organized in the first instance. Like Hamas has its origins from the Mossad and from Saudi intelligence because it was aimed at the socialist and secular Palestinian Democratic Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and Al-Fatah and so on, which were secular institutions. Hamas then attracted religious kids and religious people who were opposed to Israeli policy, but it is thoroughly penetrated by the Mossad. Just recently, for example, in Gaza, the Mossad was exposed in setting up Al-Qaeda cells in Gaza because Palestinian militants and activists caught the Palestinian figures engaged who acknowledged that they were Mossad operatives, and the documents were with them. It was recently all over the Arab press. Blowback doesn't cut it. Blowback does not tell the story of these groups and of 9/11. Blowback gives it's a kind of second line of defense. It's a defensive coloration to the reality about the role of intelligence in these events. William Arkin, who is a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst and writes frequently for the Los Angeles Times, has exposed something called P2OG in a recent series of articles in the Los Angeles Times, which is a creation of Rumsfeld and of the Defense Policy Board. It's a forward policy for using U.S. special forces in assassination and in covert ops around the world, but one of its key elements, which Arkin documented in the Los Angeles Times, is that PTOG states it will instigate terrorist acts in order to provide the opportunity to launch attacks. Black and white. Here is a smoking gun of what this is not blowback. This is a pretext, a contrivance. This is a category that has its genesis in the National Security Council. This entire category of the war on terror, of terror, is the lying rationale for the rearmament on a massive scale. The trillions of dollars of money handed over to the Pentagon could not be sold in this country without these like events. And they've set it forth. We have to find a boogeyman that has to be stopped. Just a brief digression about this. While Saddam Hussein was engaged on behalf of the United States in his war to amputate Khuzestan, The Kuwait Emir, Asaba, moved his arbitrary frontier 900 square kilometers north until he sat on the edge of the Rumaila oil field, the largest oil field in southern Iraq. He then bought the Alhambra Drilling Corporation in Santa Fe, California, for $2.3 billion because it had horizontal or slant drilling equipment. By the way, the two principals of that company were Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor of George Bush, and Robert Mossbacher, his Secretary of Commerce. They now take this slant or horizontal drilling equipment and they siphon out $14 billion of Iraqi oil. And Saddam Hussein appeals to OPEC and to the Saudis. He said, "We have expended our blood and our treasure to stabilize the Gulf from Shia radicalism, the inspiration of the revolution in Iran, which would threaten the stability of these feudal constructs in Qatar, in Oman, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia itself. And this is how you reward us." So Bush Sr. sends a message to Saddam Hussein. He says, "You've been wronged." James Baker sends a communique. "You should rectify your southern border with Kuwait." April Glasby sends a specific communique. "You have a grievance." James Baker solicits an appearance before the House Committee on Foreign Relations and Les Aspin, who says to him, "There seems to be a dispute between the government of Saddam Hussein, who we've supported, and the Emir of Kuwait over their frontier. Do we have any security interests?" "None whatsoever. This is a matter between the two countries to resolve," says James Baker. They suckered him in. They created their boogeyman. They had their rationale. This is not blowback. This is contrived pretext by our rulers to impose on the American people a series of acts that nobody would tolerate if they understood their dynamics and the truth underlying them. That's what 9/11 represents. This is the terrorizing of the American people, no less than Operation Northwood, no less than the Gulf of Tonkin, no less than the pretext for invading Little Grenada. What was it? That the U.S. students there were threatened by the Cubans? Now look, we have to not talk about the anger of the Grenadians towards the United States as the reason for their threatening American students in Grenada. That never happened. That's not true. There is no blowback. There is a deep radicalization of the masses throughout the Arab East. There is a profound detestation for these comprador regimes that sit on their necks, funded and armed by the United States, engaged in flight capital. The Emir of Kuwait, that 200-person royal feudal family, in 1991 had $2.8 trillion, according to the New York Times, in U.S. and European banks. It's flight capital. What this operation is about today is simply to deny them their cut. They want to break up this thing, OPEC, and to take all of it for themselves. They want to have their own troops on the ground. They want to recolonize these places. They don't need this comprador ruling class anymore. That's what this is. So please, when we talk about the meaning of 9/11, let it be understood. This is the use of power by a degenerating capitalist order whose economy is in permanent crisis. Fictive capital dominates capitalism today. Ever-vanishing productive use of capital in the United States or abroad. Its derivatives, its fictive trading, its instruments that are just paper shuffling, and they have huge crises where banks who have been laundering this money and passing it around like confetti are caught out. And trillions of dollars of productive value are lost in a flash in these markets. And that is translated into mass starvation across the planet. Epidemic disease. Terrible crises in which the social infrastructure of every society is in near collapse. The tragedy of Africa, a virtual genocide inflicted on that continent. That's what the 9/11 is designed to permit. It's intended to impose upon us a numbed acquiescence in these murderous designs. It's necessary to speak this truth, to document this reality, and to arm our people with the understanding that will allow us to challenge these people for power, to bring them to book. This is a gangster kleptocracy. It ain't just Bush, but he's certainly one of them.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out tonight. We went really late. Maya and Ralph, thank you. Yes.
Please, I'm so sorry I didn't do this before. I want to express our great appreciation to Bonnie Faulkner and to Guns and Butter, and I want you all to listen to Guns and Butter every Wednesday at 2. It is the dynamite vehicle for this very kind
of
understanding and information.
To Treason at the Top. Treason at the Top is our gift to you for your generous contribution to sustain WBAI of $100. 212-209-2950. And what an ending. What an ending. That was the last of the question and answer. It's an hour-long question and answer period. Many questions over many topics related to Treason at the Top. 212-209-2950. These are the last few minutes this portion of the WBAI Fund Drive, and your last opportunity to acquire Treason at the Top. We'll be with you next week from 7 to 9 p.m. with a different premium special, Testing the Waters, about military rule in America, but this is a good basis for it. Treason at the Top. Russ?
Well, you know, Maya, we talk about the necessity for listener-sponsored radio, free speech radio, and we talk about the need of listener-sponsored radio for your support to sustain itself. Let's put this in a little perspective, brothers and sisters. The United States publication Insight on the News reported on August 10, 2001, quote, every year, trillions of dollars go unaccounted by federal agents. Robert Lieberman, the Deputy Inspector General of the Department of Defense, admitted that $4.4 trillion in the Pentagon's books had to be cooked to compile required statements. I'm still quoting. In 1 year, $1.1 trillion was simply gone. No one is sure where and to whom the money went. The article continues, untold trillions of dollars are stolen every year and disappear into offshore numbered accounts, holding companies, and banks without records. And this article spells out that in the year 2000, the Pentagon lost over $855 billion in individual taxes that the IRS collected in 1999. And on September 10th, 2001, the day before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, CBS News and its anchor, Dan Rather, reported that the Pentagon had lost another $2.3 trillion, fully one quarter of its budget for the decade. What does this mean, brothers and sisters? A gangster kleptocracy. As I like to quote Helen Caldicott, who is the noted anti-nuclear activist from Australia, she calculated $1 trillion represents $1,000 spent every minute since the life of Jesus. They are cannibalizing the infrastructure of our society, brothers and sisters. This tiny, rotten, corrupt, corporate gangster elite that calls itself the government of the United States, that finances the two political parties that are but one instrument of capitalist rule. They are pauperizing our many. We have, as I often cite, more infant mortality in Harlem than in Bangladesh, brothers and sisters. One out of four children hungry in the United States. We need to be able to continue to inform our constituency about this fundamental reality about capitalist society. Please continue your support for this programming. Sustain taking aim. Support WBAI. Keep free speech radio alive. We are going to continue to mobilize and to inform, and we need our constituents, our brothers and sisters, to sustain this possibility.
212-209-2950. One thing is interesting when you look at the 2005 budget that was presented by President Bush. The individual income tax that's collected in the United States from you, from me, from working people, $873.8 billion. Now, corporate income tax is only one quarter of that. It's $230 billion. 50 years ago, corporate income tax was a major part of the federal budget. They have shifted responsibility from corporations to the working people of this country and provide tax breaks for the very wealthy. Tax breaks, which will be over $1 trillion. Now, if you look at the defense, the so-called defense, the military-industrial complex, $450.5 billion. That's just the top line, the exposed line. That doesn't include the $100 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. That doesn't include the money that is goes for the military under the State Department, the money that goes for the so-called war on drugs in Colombia, the money that is spent in the Philippines, the private armies. Then that money actually comes through the Department of State. If you look at that, you see that most of your hard-earned money is going to pay for the war machine. It's half of the discretionary funding. It's more than half of the individual income tax that is collected each year by the federal government from our pockets to their pockets. Ralph, 212, we have only a few minutes left for you to call in for Treason at the Top. Your generous contribution of $100, 212-209-2950. If you can support more than that, get many copies, and make a bigger contribution to WBAI. If you're unemployed or a student, and we do have low-income memberships for WBAI, please become a member if you're not so now. If you are a member, you can sustain WBAI as you have been for many, many years. Ralph.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Maya. You were citing the kleptocracy, as I had been doing as well. I want to mention that there was another broadcast that took place in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And that was a broadcast by Dan Rather, again of CBS News, the day after, on September 12th, when he interviewed Tom Kennedy, who is director of the Federal Emergency Management Administration, known as FEMA. Now, the origins of FEMA, as we've often documented, derive from Oliver North's schemes for mass detention camps in the United States and the roundup of hundreds of thousands of people, all those very alive and well, these plans. It's part of the Northern Command. It's part of Operation Garden Plot. The FEMA official, Tom Kennedy, interviewed by Dan Rather on September 12th, was asked by Rather about FEMA's response to the catastrophe of 9/11, and here's what occurred. The director, Tom Kennedy, said, well, FEMA was well prepared for September 11th. We arrived in New York to cope with the calamity the day before on September 10th. The day before on September 10th, Tom Kennedy telling Dan Rather on September 12th that FEMA was indeed well prepared. They were there before the event occurred. This prescience, by the way, was not an isolated occurrence. I've documented in the World Trade Center Uncensored History how intelligence agency after intelligence agency had all of the elements of 9/11 fully in their information packets, that critical individuals were apprised of it, including former Secretary of State George Shultz on September 7th. It prompted the San Francisco Chronicle to run a story with the headline, How Could the United States Not Have Known? Brothers and sisters, the realities of treason at the top are that our rulers are the terrorists, employing the state apparatus to terrorize the American people into, as Maya describes it, a numbed acquiescence for their barbarous plans of genocide abroad, of pauperization and repression at home, We must continue to expose this. We are committed to that objective. But once again, it's your support for this station and this programming that permits that to happen. Stay with us. We will stand with you. Support WBAI.
212-209-2950. Our gift to you is Treason at the Top for your contribution of $100. We have just a couple of more minutes, and then Robert Knight is going to be with us for the roundup of the Super Tuesday. But remember, whoever comes through at the top for Super Tuesday in the Democratic Party, they're still part of the Treason at the Top, documented in this 2-CD premium. Your generous donation to WBAI, and it's really a donation to yourself because it keeps WBAI, the station upon which you rely, on the air, broadcasting 24/7. 212-209-2950. Ralph, the last word.
Yes, I want to quote two people here. The American poet Ezra Pound, oddly enough, once said that the technique of infamy is to invent two lies and get people arguing heatedly over which one of them is true. That, in essence, is the two-party system in the United States, the so-called two-party system, the one big property party with two names. And then there's Eugene Debs, the gallant and heroic rank-and-file trade union leader, first of the IWW and then the American Socialist Party. And Gene Debs, imprisoned under the Sedition Acts of the First World War, made the following statement when he ran and got over a million votes for president at that time on the socialist ticket. Debs said, "It is better, brothers and sisters, to support what you want and not get it, than support what you don't want and get it." Well, brothers and sisters, let's get it. Let's support Free Speech Radio. Let's support WBAI. Let's support Speaking Truth to Power. And let's plan on building that instrument, that political vehicle for the fight back, for the struggle, for the revolutionary transformation, which alone can bring to justice the kleptocracy that terrorizes the American people.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week for a special broadcast on Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m.
Tikin do bini ay, tatan sa chinda karo.